Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Neoadjuvant chemoradiation therapy of rectal cancer is one of the most active areas of current clinical research in gastrointestinal neoplasias, and I asked Dr. Joel Tepper to review where we are with current non-protocol therapy and where we're heading in new clinical trials.
I think one of the big differences over the last few years is a better understanding of how to integrate radiation therapy into the overall treatment plan, as well as the beginnings of understanding how to modulate the chemotherapy that's done both with radiation and using radiation just purely as an adjuvant. There's also a lot of interesting work that's going on, not all of which has come into standard clinical use, in terms of staging, which in fact may have a huge impact in terms of how we actually manage the patients. Better understanding of risk factors, which will help us define treatments much more accurately as we move forward. Many of these are not exactly new. They're evolving processes that people have been working on for a number of years, but the evolution is getting more and more exciting. And as the new drugs come along, the opportunity to use those drugs in rectal cancer produces really exciting opportunities, both in terms of the local therapy as well as for treating systemic disease.
What about the issue of men who've been treated with radiation therapy for prostate cancer? I know you've published on that. Can you talk about what we know about that?
Well, we've known for a long time that radiation is carcinogenic, and that if you give substantial doses of radiation to most structures in the body, the incidence of cancer will increase over time. And therefore, when we did the study, and Nancy Baxter was the lead author on that study, we found that indeed there was a significant increase in the incidence of rectal cancer in patients who had radiation for prostate cancer. If you look at many studies across the board, the increased incidence of a cancer in an anatomical site related to radiation, a lot of those studies show about a 50% increase in incidence over baseline. So if you're dealing with a baseline incidence of 1%, you may go up to 1.5% for some disease. And that's the order of magnitude of what we saw for the increased incidence in rectal cancer. I do not think that means that one should not use radiation for prostate cancer. It simply means that is one of the pieces that needs to be in the equation. And those may be patients who need to be screened a little more carefully than the general population. It puts patients in a higher risk category for the disease.
Any difference between implant or external beam?
I don't think we have that information. What one would expect is because an implant treats a smaller volume of the rectum than external beam does, that it might be somewhat less than external beam, but that's speculation on my part.
Do you think this is a practical enough issue that it should be mentioned to men considering radiation therapy for prostate cancer?
I think it probably should be mentioned. I don't think one should make a big deal of it, but I think it's enough of an issue that it is a legitimate risk and it's potentially a very serious risk. And therefore, I think mentioning it is appropriate.
You were talking about risk factors, and of course, that ties into staging. Can you talk about what we've learned in these last couple of years that sort of added to our knowledge base on that issue?
Well, number one, if there's anything that I would want to emphasize, is that we're in an age of molecular everything and elaborate testing. And what we found out is that doing some very standard, straightforward things, things that we should have been doing all along, can make a real difference in terms of understanding risk and outcome from the disease. And it emphasizes both the surgery and the pathology of what goes on and then the interpretation of those data. So there have been a series of articles, for instance, published by Len Gunderson and me, in which Len has taken the lead, looking at the impact of the T stage and the N stage in outcome of patients with rectal cancer. So we stage our patients as a T something, N something disease. And it's been known for years that N stage is important, that if you have positive nodes, you do a whole lot worse than if you don't have positive nodes. And in fact, many of the treatment algorithms have been based almost entirely on the premise that N stage dominated everything in terms of outcome. If you look carefully at the data for rectal cancer, and you look both at the impact of the T stage of the tumor and the N stage of the tumor, what you really see is that both of them are important somewhat independently. And in point of fact, if you look at it very carefully, someone with T2N1 disease probably, if anything, might have a slightly better prognosis than someone with a T3N0 disease. Within a given N stage, so if you have an N0 or if you have, let's say, an N1, what the T stage is matters a lot for your risk of recurrence. And that's risk of recurrence, both local and distant. And if anything, the impact, and this is an impact that's seen on survival. It is not some ethereal impact. These are big, big survival differences. Survival differences that are far larger than any differences that you see from an additive therapeutic intervention to surgery. So more than the effect of chemotherapy or more than the effect of radiation or putting those together. These are large effects that you see between these various subsets. So related to that is a study of how you evaluate tissues. An example is a paper that I wrote a few years back looking at an analysis we did of the patients from the intergroup study 114, which was a study in which all patients with rectal cancer were treated postoperatively with chemotherapy, then radiation chemotherapy, and then more chemotherapy. And for this analysis, the good part was that there was no difference between the therapeutic interventions, so we were able to lump all of the treatment categories together. And if you looked at the number of lymph nodes that the pathologist found in the specimen, that was of great import in terms of outcome. More specifically, if you looked at patients with T3N0 disease, they were all negative, all had confirmed T3 disease. If the pathologist found 0 to 8 nodes, the outcome was far worse than the outcome for someone where the pathologist found 14 or more nodes in the specimen. And again, this difference was much bigger than the differences we see from the therapeutic intervention. What this suggests to me is that how we pick the patients at high risk may be extremely important both in defining the outcomes of the studies, but also may be extremely important in defining who we should treat and who we shouldn't treat with adjuvant therapies. And it could be that a number of patients, if you have a patient with T3N0 disease who has been really very well staged with many nodes that are negative, maybe that patient doesn't need adjuvant therapy, or at least not the same level of adjuvant therapy as they would otherwise. So the other issue that relates to this is this an issue from what the surgeon did, how good an operation the surgeon did, or is this an issue of how well and how carefully the pathologist looked at the specimen? We can't answer this definitively from that study, but if anything, it suggests that it was more of an issue of what the pathologist did. And the reason I say that is because for the patients with T3N0 disease, there was a very large effect in terms of how many nodes the pathologist found. For patients with T3N1 disease, there was a lesser effect. And for patients with T3N2 disease, there was no discernible effect, suggesting that this was a stage migration. If it was the surgeon just doing a better operation, I would expect that the largest effect would be for the patients with N2 disease. You do a better operation, a bigger operation, you cure more patients. In reality, it's probably good surgery and good pathology that counts. It's probably not just one or the other, but it looked a little bit more like pathology. As I started saying before, these are kind of simple things, things we've known for years and years. But now we're learning better how to utilize this information, and hopefully we'll be able to translate that into how we give and to whom we give adjuvant therapy.
Not to get too far off on the tangent, but of course a similar finding has been seen in colon cancer in terms of number of nodes examined. There also, do you think it's mainly the pathologist?
Well, interestingly, when you look at the colon, it does not appear to be necessarily that way. So I'm not sure the same issue holds. And obviously, from any one study, you don't know for sure. What is clear is that both for colon cancer and for rectal cancer, evaluating a large number of nodes is really important. And I must say, if we see patients at UNC and the pathologist comes back and says there are only 6 nodes in a colon specimen, we tell them to go back and relook at the specimen. The other caveat you need to be aware of is that these are all data for patients who had initial surgery. And if patients have upfront radiation and chemotherapy, it is in fact much harder to recover that larger number of nodes. The nodes do shrink down after radiation. They're harder to find, so don't get too upset with your pathologist if they find 10 nodes in the post-radiation setting.
So when you have your pathologist go back and look, they usually find more nodes, and if so, how many?
Oh, I think it depends on the residents who's putting up the specimen. And there have been series that have looked at surgical pathology clearance of fat where people find 40, 50 nodes. In a typical pathology practice right now, those types of issues are simply too time-consuming to recover that large number of nodes. But if you can recover a goodly number, and I think the standards that most people are thinking about now is about 13 or 14 nodes as a minimal number for someone who has not already been treated with radiation.
What do we know about the prognosis and also the question of adjuvant therapy in patients who've got neoadjuvant, you know, chemotherapy plus radiation therapy? How do we interpret the nodes there?
So it's harder to interpret the node count in those patients. One still should be able to define nodes in those patients. But the gold standard of a minimum of 13 or 14 nodes probably doesn't apply, and you probably can have that as a reasonable standard. There have been a couple of studies that have looked at and demonstrated the increased difficulty of finding nodes in those patients.
What do you think a rational way is to approach adjuvant therapy after neoadjuvant chemoradiation therapy in terms of whether to give it and which regimen?
So there are two very interesting issues that relate to this. My standard thinking has always been that the definition of the disease extent prior to the initiation of any therapy should determine the use of additional adjuvant chemotherapy after the completion of local therapy. And therefore, if one staged a patient as T3 node-positive disease, and on that basis gave that patient neoadjuvant radiation and chemotherapy, and if at surgery there was no disease in the specimen, I've always advocated and still advocate the use of adjuvant chemotherapy afterwards. And the rationale for this is really very simple, that if one is treating patients for micrometastatic disease elsewhere in the body, and if the patient had a great response to radiation in the pelvis, that should not impact in any significant way the need for adjuvant chemotherapy to affect disease elsewhere in the body. And I still hold to that. The bulk of the data suggests that patients who respond well to adjuvant chemoradiation therapy and have complete response have better outcomes. But most of those patients have also been treated with additional chemotherapy. But a number of people have at least raised the issue of whether those patients, in fact, need additional chemotherapy. My view is that they still do at the present time, but it's conceivable that that will change.
Can you talk a little bit about what you consider standard of care in terms of preoperative evaluation of patients with rectal cancer?
So there are two basic issues that one needs to define when you see a patient with rectal cancer, outside of their overall medical condition and their overall ability to tolerate therapy. And one is the extent of the local disease, and the other is the extent of the distant disease. The local disease is typically evaluated by a combination of CT scan, endoscopy, rectal examination, and ultrasound. The digital rectal exam is still extremely important, in my view, because it defines a number of issues that are not as well defined by the other parameters. Number one, it defines where the tumor is with respect to the anal sphincter, which really helps define how you think about that treatment in terms of whether a patient will need an abdominal peroneal resection or can get by with a low anterior resection. It also defines the mobility of the tumor. And for a tumor that is a clinical T4 disease that is fixed on pelvic sidewall or sacrum or the like, the management may very well be different. And that is not necessarily a factor that's easily determined by anything but a good rectal examination. The ultrasound is becoming increasingly important, or has become important, because it is what can define both the T stage and the N stage more accurately pre-treatment than any other approach that we have. The difficulty with ultrasound is, number one, that it's very significantly operator dependent, and secondly, that even in good hands, the error rates, both in terms of overstaging and understaging, is significant. If you have an inexperienced ultrasonographer, the results are probably not going to be very good.
Both ways?
Both ways. And one needs to interpret ultrasound with an understanding of what's happened to the patient. I have taken a patient who was told to me has T3 disease by ultrasound, examined the patient and said, "I don't believe it," and sent the patient directly to surgery. You can be fooled by deep biopsies producing an inflammatory response, and you can be confused just because of misinterpretation of the layers of the bowel wall. It's not a very clean test that gives you a very unequivocal yes or no answer. But it's still the best test that we have standardly available, and therefore it's what I think should be used if you have an experienced ultrasonographer.
Any other imaging techniques that look promising to you?
Yeah, there is. So I would add that everyone gets a CT scan of the pelvis as part, and I think it's a good idea, but it doesn't add a whole lot. The test that I think is interesting is doing some more sophisticated MRI. So there's a phased array coil approach, and this has been promulgated heavily by a couple of European investigators, more so than the United States, which gives a view of the pelvis and the perirectal soft tissues that are really far better than you can get with other conventional imaging approaches. Having said that, this is also going to be dependent on the expertise of the person actually getting the images and certainly of interpreting the images. But I think it has more potential than anything else that I've seen out there right now.
You talked about the distance from the sphincter in terms of determining the type of surgery. What's your guideline, and what goes on in clinical practice in that regard?
Well, I can tell you what goes on in our practice in that regard. We don't do very many abdominal perineal resections nowadays. And if a tumor is on the sphincter, we view that that patient will for sure need an APR. Once it's up a centimeter, centimeter and a half above the sphincter, we then think that we at least have a good fighting chance of not doing an APR and getting away with an LAR, often with a coloanal anastomosis. But the other things you need to consider is that there has to be adequate sphincter function when you start. And there are patients, especially in the elderly, whose tumor may be something where you could preserve sphincter. But if you give that patient radiation and then you do surgery, the likelihood that they will have a sphincter that works well and that will give them a good quality of life will not, in fact, be very high. So you need to evaluate the quality of the sphincter in that patient. And I have, on occasion, recommended patients have APRs or at least diverting colostomies because the sphincter function is simply not adequate to start with.
What do we know about what's going on, particularly in community practice, having had a family member whose initial opinion was to have an APR who went to get a second opinion is now 5 years later with a low resection and doing great? I've been pretty interested in this. What do we know about what actually happens in practice?
I think what we know about surgery is that more experienced surgeons do a better job in terms of outcome. And I think more experienced surgeons know how to do a better operation in terms of clearing the tumor, and they know how to do better operations in terms of preserving anal sphincter. There have been studies that have been done in the United States. There was one study where we looked at patients from three randomized U.S. intergroup trials and looked at surgeons who had 10 or more patients who were entered on those studies and used that as a surrogate for the experience of the surgeon. And what we found, that the local failure rate was almost half in those experienced surgeons as it was in the other surgeons. There have been studies from Europe where they've done training courses to teach surgeons how to do the proper operation for rectal cancer. And they found the local failure rate falling by about a half from training programs. And clearly, a less experienced surgeon is less likely to want to go ahead and do a coloanal anastomosis or something of that sort. So I think having an experienced, well-trained surgeon is critically important for good outcome, both in terms of tumor control and in terms of function.
I was talking with Bruce Minsky about this same issue. And, you know, when you look at the quality of life issues in rectal cancer, not that they're not important in breast cancer and colon cancer and other tumors, but to me here, when we talk about whether or not a patient's going to have a colostomy, whether or not a patient has local recurrence, these are huge, huge quality of life issues. I'm kind of surprised there's not more attention or noise being made about this.
I am too. I don't have a good answer. There have been attempts in the United States. The American College of Surgeons, for instance, tried to develop a training program to train surgeons who are already out in the community to teach them how to do good total mesorectal excisions, which is the kind of surgery that we think should be done for these patients. And I'm not sure whether it was the logistics or there were other problems, but it was really very hard to get that off the ground. As more and more surgeons are being trained by other people who are experienced just in standard training programs, I think we will see the overall quality improve. But even if you have a surgeon who is well-trained, if they do one of these operations every 2 years, I can't imagine that they will do as good a job in terms of getting tumor control and in terms of function as a more experienced surgeon.
What advice would you give a patient in this regard, in terms of sort of, you know, obviously you can always talk about getting a second opinion, but also not just the patient, but maybe the primary care physician in terms of a red light that should go off in terms of maybe thinking about a second opinion?
Well, I think the best thing to do is to try to get some understanding of what the experience of that surgeon is. Does the surgeon really do a fair amount of this operation? Or was the surgeon really trained in this operation? And if it's a small community hospital, it's a general surgeon who's doing every kind of operation under the sun, maybe an extremely good surgeon, but that surgeon is unlikely to have the specialized expertise that's needed for this operation. A good colon cancer operation probably can be done by any reasonably competent surgeon. A good rectal cancer operation needs someone who really is experienced and very well trained specifically in that aspect of cancer surgery.
Let's talk a little bit about chemo radiation therapy and also new clinical research approaches to rectal cancer. What are some of the major rectal cancer trials right now that are ongoing? Which do you participate in?
So in the United States, we've tried to coordinate the adjuvant trials in rectal cancer through what has previously been the GI Intergroup. And so we now have a GI steering committee of the clinical trials working group, which is really the old intergroup. And so we've tried to coordinate the trials. And there are at present two trials that have been relatively recently activated. And they've been designed carefully so that you can actually enter patients on both of these studies. So the first is a study from the NSABP evaluating preoperative radiation and chemotherapy for rectal cancer patients with a 2-by-2 randomization where patients get randomized either to continuous infusion 5-FU or capecitabine with radiation, and then have a second randomization to receive or not receive oxaliplatin with radiation. And the idea was to use oxaliplatin to increase the rate of pathological complete response, hopefully improve the local control rate, and perhaps have the advantage of having some additional systemic effect at the same time. Patients are entered on that study, and then they have surgery, and then they can be randomized to an ECOG study in which all patients get FOLFOX, and then they are randomized to receive or not receive bevacizumab.
Kind of paralleling the NSABP COH study in colon cancer, what's the entry criteria for that study?
So the entry criteria are basically what they've been for almost all studies to date, which is T3 and or node positive disease.
In terms of the preoperative part of this, Chris Crane wrote an editorial, I guess about a year and a half ago, at the point before the oxaliplatin kind of had come in, criticizing, looking at the issue of capecitabine versus continuous infusion 5-FU in terms of whether or not it was a worthy sort of research question. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's not the world's most exciting question, but it would be a question that would be happy to have the answer to.
How do you approach those patients in your own practice in terms of selection of chemotherapy, capecitabine versus 5-FU?
So at the present time, our standard is to use continuous infusion 5-FU. That's the approach that has the most experience. It has the data that is positive. And so I still think that's appropriate to use that as a standard. And we do use capecitabine in patients in whom there's a reason not to use continuous infusion 5-FU. Patient won't tolerate the pump, or they can't have an indwelling catheter for some reason. But the majority of patients end up getting continuous infusion 5-FU.
I'm always curious about how people discuss these things with patients and how they present them. Do you bring up capecitabine as a possibility, or do you wait and see if there's going to be some kind of an issue in terms of the 5-FU?
Well, our standard has been to use continuous infusion 5-FU. So we usually present that to the patient as our preferred method of treatment. And we certainly acknowledge that there are other approaches, but that is usually the standard that we put forward.
What do we know about oxaliplatin and rectal cancer during radiation therapy?
Well, there have been a number of phase 2 trials. There was a phase 2 trial that I participated in that was run by the CLGB, where we based the phase 1-2 study on some preclinical data that we had, and with an attempt to maximize radiation sensitization with oxaliplatin. And because of that, we gave weekly oxaliplatin and did not give some of the other schedules that are out there, and showed a maximum tolerated dose of oxaliplatin of 60 milligrams per square meter per week. And that is, in fact, the basis for the NSABP trial that is running forward at the present time.
Now, at that dose, what kind of side effects do you see that you wouldn't see without it?
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that you wouldn't see without it, because I think it's basically the same kind of side effects. But I think when you add additional drug, things just get a little bit worse.
Same thing, just more of it.
And I think you get a little more of it, and you need a balance between how much you add of one drug versus the other. And at a dose in the range of 50 or 60 milligrams per square meter per week, I think toxicity is going to be quite acceptable. But over the years that I've been in practice, I found it much harder now to give preoperative radiation for rectal cancer than it was 20 years ago, because we're adding more chemotherapy to that, and just adding 5-FU to that increases the acute toxicity and makes it harder to get patients through therapy. Having said that, it's not that hard to get the patients through therapy, but patients will occasionally get sick and will occasionally have problems. I would add that oftentimes capecitabine is presented as an easy way out, and I think that's often not the case. I've seen significant toxicity of capecitabine with radiation, and it's clearly very heavily related to the drug administration put on top of a radiation course.
What about bevacizumab and rectal cancer? There's been some exciting work. Chris Willits did some interesting work, and I think MD Anderson's also looking at that in rectal cancer. What do we know about that?
I think right now we still don't know a whole lot. The use of virtually all of the biologics with radiation produce a really exciting opportunity. When you look at the in vitro cell work or animal work, one sees that virtually all of the biologics produce substantial radiation sensitization. And to the extent that some of the sensitization may really be preferential for tumors, this is a very exciting opportunity to be able to get a much better therapeutic effect. I'd suggest one of the most impressive results by adding a biologic to anything is in head and neck cancer using cetuximab with radiation therapy. That's about as good a result as we've seen in any disease by the addition of a biologic. Whether we can produce results that are that good by adding a biologic to radiation and rectal cancer is something that only time will tell, but it produces some very exciting opportunities. Chris Willits' work is really beautiful work demonstrating some of the biology of the issues, but it also shows some of the difficulties in interpretation of how we should use the drug. There are issues of dose effect. Much of that work has been based on the scientific work of Rakesh Jain, who was at Mass General, who believes that much of the effect of the VEGF inhibitors relates to a normalization of vasculature rather than a destruction of vasculature. Having said that, after giving bevacizumab alone, Chris demonstrated significant tumor reduction. They've postulated that may simply be due to a change in intratumoral pressure and tumor swelling is going down. And that all may be true, but I don't think we understand how these drugs are working very well. And we need to approach the studies in an organized fashion to be able to produce the best results.
What actual clinical reports are there right now of bevacizumab, cetuximab, and other biologics in rectal cancer?
I think they're just starting to come out, and I think it's really too early to say that there's anything out there that's very even close to definitive at the present time.
Any other research or clinical questions that you get from community-based oncologists about this?
Well, I guess there are a few issues that people ask me about. And one is the issue of patients with very small tumors and whether they can be treated with fairly minimal surgery and radiation. This is something that's been around for quite a number of years. And the answer is that you can cure a substantial number of patients by a local excision and then using radiation and chemotherapy postoperatively. The problem is that the local failure rate is higher than you'd like it to be in those patients. So for patients with T2 N0 disease with local excision and radiation, local failure is probably in the range of 20%. Not a super high number, but for something that should have a local failure rate of well under 10%, that's fairly high. Despite that, there are some patients who we occasionally treat, or I treat with local excision and radiation. Sometimes they're very elderly patients. Seen some patients who are recently status post-myocardial infarction, where they simply can't do an operation or need to be just much more conservative about what was done, or the occasional patient who simply refuses more aggressive therapy. So it's a therapeutic option that needs to be considered. Perhaps if we get better with the effect of the biologics with radiation, we'll be able to do a better job yet of controlling this microscopic residual disease after local excision. The other extreme is what do you do patients with truly locally advanced disease? And I don't think the techniques that are available have changed enormously over the years, but I think it's really important for many treating physicians to understand that there are things that we can do that are perhaps a little bit more aggressive that can produce very good results in patients with locally advanced non-metastatic tumors. And so the way we often treat these patients is start them off with upfront radiation and chemotherapy, take them to surgery, attempt to resect the disease as well as possible, but adding additional radiation at the time of surgery in the form of intraoperative radiation therapy. It's not a brand new technique. It's been around. I've personally used it since the early 1980s, but it's an approach that for selected patients with locally advanced disease, I think can improve outcomes. The data, unfortunately, are not as convincing as they could be because randomized studies have not been done on this group of patients. But it gives another tool that we can use for patients who have or are very high risk of having some residual disease after surgery.
How do you actually do the procedure?
There are a couple of different ways. What we do at UNC is the patient has the operation. We have a special machine that's in the operating room. The operation is done. The radiation oncologist is there at the appropriate time. And there's a cylinder that's actually placed. We have a whole series of cylinders that's placed directly over the site of high risk for tumor involvement. The accelerator that's in the room is then mounted to this cylinder. So the beam is directed right down on the cylinder. The cylinder acts both as a normal tissue retractor to keep normal tissues outside of the field and at the same time confines the radiation beam within it. And then everyone steps out of the room for a couple of minutes with monitoring the anesthesia from outside the room. And in about 2 minutes, one can give fairly high doses of radiation. which is really concentrated on that specific area of concern.
What kind of dose?
Typically, dose is in the range of an additional 1,000 to 1,500 centigrays, which given in a single fraction is worth biologically more than that.
What about oxaliplatin off protocol in these patients?
We have not been using oxaliplatin off protocol. I think the data are very preliminary to do that off study, so we have not been doing that.
We were talking before about variations in surgery. What about variations in radiation therapy? Any thoughts about rectal cancer, you know, particularly as opposed to other cancers in terms of how much of a variation there is and what the impact might be?
I think there is a difference in terms of how the radiation is given. Interestingly, one of the areas where it is likely most important is in terms of how one treats the very lowest portion of the field. And specifically, it's the radiation of the anus that causes an issue. Radiation of the anus and the perianal skin causes a lot of acute morbidity to the patient. And in many situations, maybe in most situations, it's not necessary to irradiate the full extent of the anal canal. And certainly, it's rarely indicated to irradiate the perianal skin to any significant extent. But in addition to the acute morbidity, there have been a number of studies that have shown increased difficulty with bowel function for years after surgery and radiation therapy. And some of that is related to anal sphincters that do not work very well. And therefore, trying to design the field to stay off the sphincter or to minimize the dose to the sphincter when the tumors are not extremely low in the rectum is something that I think produces a substantial long-term benefit to the patient. Unfortunately, I think a lot of radiation oncologists kind of ignore that issue and use stylized radiation fields that are based on bony anatomy and not on the anatomy of the anus and the rectum for that particular patient. And I think that's a significant mistake and can have a significant impact in long-term outcome.
You were talking about some of the questions that you receive from physicians in practice. Any others?
Well, sort of the corollary of the patient with the locally advanced disease is that of patients with locally recurrent disease. And those are very difficult management patients. And so what we do for those patients are, if we can give additional external beam radiation with chemotherapy, we do that. Sometimes we're very limited because they've had a lot of external radiation already. So we'll oftentimes take those patients to surgery and use intraoperative radiation therapy as our sole means of additional radiation delivery at that time. I would add, we have a machine in the operating room for intraoperative radiation therapy, but in fact, you can deliver the radiation with implant techniques, so it doesn't have to be a dedicated linear accelerator in the room. But there are some difficulties when you use implant techniques.
Pain is often a problem in these patients. Anything new in terms of supporting patients with that problem?
I'm not aware of anything significant. And some of those patients who have intractable pain, we have a good pain clinic and we try to get patients there. We usually can get that pain controlled. We'll sometimes add radiation beyond what we consider to be standard tolerance doses of radiation, especially if we can avoid small bowel radiation. And we can usually get some level of control of pain, but it can be an enormous problem, patients, especially with recurrent disease.
Where do you see things headed in terms of clinical research and rectal cancer? Where do you think we'll be in 5 or 10 years?
I think there'll be two major areas of change. One is we'll be defining much more precisely who needs treatment and who doesn't need treatment. And that's true both for drug as well as for radiation. And the other is I think we're going to be using the various biologics that we have either available now or some that are maybe just a glimmer in the minds of some chemist somewhere to combine with radiation, to combine with chemotherapy, to have much better ability to control this disease. It's even possible that we'll be putting the surgeon out of business for selected patients with these tumors. And we may be able to define a cohort of patients in whom using radiation and drug alone with a biologic and without surgery is an appropriate first therapy for these and only using salvage surgery. Whether that will actually come to pass, I don't know, but I wouldn't be too surprised.
How about colon cancer? Where do you see that heading?
Well, I don't think there's going to be many changes at all in local therapy for colon cancer. And I think it's mostly going to be in both risk definition, defining which patients are at high risk of failure, selecting out some patients who perhaps are being treated now who don't need to be treated, defining some subsets of patients in whom specific agents or specific approaches are likely to be effective, and to be able to direct therapy more precisely for the biology of the individual patient. And by individual patient, I mean both the patient's tumor as well as the genetic composition of that patient himself. Obviously, this applies both to rectal and colon cancer.
What have you seen at this point that sort of you find encouraging in that regard?
We're finding that there are a lot of differences that we can ascertain. We know the differences are there. And since we know the differences are there, we should be able to figure out subsets of patients in whom we can change therapy based on those differences. The challenge is, in fact, that there are so many differences that knowing how to combine them for an individual patient will be an enormous challenge.